First up, I believe it's going to be Kathy Hammett, Vice President of Medical and Scientific Affairs for the Sjogren's Foundation, who's going to start off the COVID vaccination presentation.
Thank you. And we did have a slide of the committee, but I don't know about all of you all, but we knew that as soon as we started getting a vaccination that that everybody would want to know, should I take it? Is it safe? Will it work? I too had those questions. So anyway, the foundation decided it was really imperative that as soon as we knew a vaccination would be on the scene soon, that we put together the right people to really look at this in Sjogren's. So first of all, Dr. Alan Baer, who is the director of the Jerome L. Green Sjogren's Center at Johns Hopkins, and he also is our current chair of our Sjogren's Foundation Medical and Scientific Advisory Board, agreed to lead this effort. So we were so grateful to him for chairing this. And he and I talked about who should be on the committee. And of course, Dr. Baer was really plugged into just the right people. So we got Cassandra Calabrese, who's at the Cleveland Clinic. She is in rheumatology and infectious diseases and also focuses on vaccinations. So we were really lucky to get her on board. And then Stephen Carsons, who's a former chair of our Medical and Scientific Advisory Council, is now chief of rheumatology at NYU Winthrop. He's also senior associate dean of translational science integration, and he's also chair of the NYU Winthrop Vaccine Center for Treatment and Evaluation. So we were very fortunate to have him on board. Nancy Carteron, who's in rheumatology and immunology, both at the University of California, San Francisco, and the Sjogren's Center at the University of California, Berkeley. And she is a past chair of our Medical and Scientific Advisory Council as well. And then Marie Warren Herlenius, who's at the Karolinska Institute in Sweden. We brought her on board because she has done a lot of scholarly work on vaccinations and Sjogren specifically. So we had a really good team addressing all of the key questions for Sjogren's patients and whether they should get the COVID-19 vaccination. So I'm gonna pass it to Dr. Baer, who's gonna give us an overview of the COVID-19 vaccinations and kind of where we are and what they're all about.
So thank you very much, Kathy. It's really a pleasure to be meeting all of you. I wanted to just start by saying that after very careful consideration of the committee, it was really our very strong recommendation that people with Sjogren's should get the vaccination, that the benefits, particularly against such a deadly pandemic, are so great and the risks of the vaccination are so small that we felt that the what we call the benefit to risk ratio was so high in favor of recommending that everyone get the vaccine. Now, there are going to be a few exceptions, and I'm going to use my slides a bit to kind of cover some of the concerns, and we'll certainly have time after my few slides to answer many questions. I see that a lot of people have already written questions in, so we'll have time to cover many of those during the rest of this session. So I'm going to review just a bit of information about COVID-19. I think all of you know that the first cases just occurred a year ago in Wuhan, China. Most of the original cases were people who attended a market where they sell live animals, and that certainly raised concern that either in the process of eating these animals or being close to them, that they had contracted the virus. And it was quickly realized that these people developing this terrible respiratory infections and pneumonia and with fatal illness. This was caused by a novel beta coronavirus named SARS-CoV-2. Now, what I should tell you is that coronaviruses are nothing new to us. They're a family of RNA viruses. In fact, a third of the common cold that we all experience are related to other types of coronaviruses. So we're very familiar with these viruses. But we've also suffered in the last 20 years several pandemics, the first one being in 2002 called the SARS epidemic for severe acute respiratory stress syndrome, which was primarily started in China and occurred in Southeast Asia And it really influenced the behavior of people in Southeast Asia. So I think a lot of you are aware that many people in Southeast Asia just routinely wear masks now. And that behavior really began with that SARS epidemic in 2002. And then there was another one in the Middle East called MERS, which occurred around 2012. So we were familiar with the fact that this virus could at times cause very severe respiratory infections and pneumonia, unfortunately leading occasionally to death. And this virus, the COVID virus, has, as you all know, rapidly disseminated across the world. We know that it spread from person to person through respiratory particles. But what we did not appreciate at the beginning of this pandemic was that 40 to 50% of the transmission of the virus occurs from people who are entirely asymptomatic. So you'll remember that there was some confusion at first as to whether we should be wearing masks or not and how important that was. But we now know very clearly that much of the spread is from people who are asymptomatic. And I think you sadly have seen it in the Congress where people were huddled together last week trying to protect themselves from the rioters. And in that clustered room where some people weren't wearing masks, already three or four people have contracted the virus just in that setting. So sadly, we've had almost 400,000 Americans die from this virus. And we're reaching 23 or 24 million people affected by the virus or infected by the virus in the United States alone. So Ben, let's go on to the next slide. So I wanted to highlight that what has happened in terms of developing this vaccine is really in many ways miraculous. And I show you a picture of Barney Graham, who runs the Vaccine Research Center at the NIH. And just by happenstance, I know Barney very well because we worked together as residents at Vanderbilt University many, many years ago. He trained there and he worked there for a number of years, but in 2000 came to the NIH and set up the, or was part of the Vaccine Research Center. And he's been studying coronaviruses for a number of years, and particularly the MERS epidemic, and he's studied the SARS, and he's really specialized in how to design vaccines. And so he had done a lot of preliminary work and had developed something totally novel, which was a messenger RNA vaccine, which had not yet been used in humans, but when this virus struck in China, they were ready to go. And this timeline just highlights some of that rapid sequence of events. So the virus was first reported in December 31st, and then they reported the molecular structure of the virus as early as January 10th when it was published. And overnight, Barney and his group designed the vaccine and got a company that they were already collaborating called Moderna to start working on it. Moderna tested it in mice and within just a few weeks showed that it worked extremely well in mice and then was given permission by the government to start making this same vaccine for humans. And the trials began, as you can see, in March with the phase 3 trials, which have just been completed starting in July. And really by November, we had the first results showing that these vaccines were incredibly effective. And so by Christmas, as shown in the slide, we had the COVID-19 vaccine. There's a very nice story about Barney's efforts in the New Yorker this week, showing how nervous he was that he had to pick the right sequence of the messenger RNA to produce this vaccine. And he was worried that he had made a mistake, but then he was rewarded when he saw the results of the trials that he actually had done this all very correctly. But it was a very human aspect to realize how important his decision-making was. And he was the one who had to sit there and decide at the final recipe for this vaccine. So I'm really glad that it worked out so well for him. So next slide. So this is just an overview of what we mean by messenger RNA vaccines. So there's a picture of it in the upper left-hand corner, which is the vaccine itself is composed of really oil droplets. The other way of putting it is that they're lipid nanoparticles. So these oil droplets are incredibly, incredibly small. But inside each of the droplets is a strand of messenger RNA. And messenger RNA is the genetic material that it serves as a template for telling the cell how to construct a particular protein. And so those lipid droplets get taken up by the cells that once you get the injection of the vaccine, it's taken up by the cells. It fuses with the membrane, the messenger RNA is released into the cell, and your body starts to use the recipe or the template of the messenger RNA to make a protein that is vital to the virus called viral spike protein, which is on the surface of the viral particle. And your cells start to express that viral particle on the cell surface. And since it's not something the body has seen before, it's foreign, our immune systems recognize it as foreign and start making antibodies to it, which is how we become immune to the virus. Now, I just want to emphasize several things. One is that this messenger RNA does not enter your nucleus of the cells. It does not become part of your DNA. And in fact, the messenger RNA molecule or strip gets quickly degraded after it's used. It only makes one transcription of the viral protein. So you don't have to worry that it's permanently altering your body or cells and it's not interfering with your DNA. And the other nice thing about these vaccines is that they're easily adaptable. You can quickly change the recipe of the messenger RNA and adapt to new variants, which we may need to do in the future. So let's go on to the next slide. So as you all know, we've had two major trials of these messenger RNA COVID vaccines, one done by Pfizer and one done by Moderna. And this slide just summarizes the phase three trials that were conducted late last year to prove that these were in fact effective vaccines. And so you can see in both trials, a large number of participants, 43,548 in the Pfizer and 30,420 in the Moderna trial. And you'll see a little bit of the age range. So Pfizer had individuals 16 and older, whereas Moderna was 18 and older. So we do allow children over the age of 16 or older to get the vaccine. And each of them was constructed so that people would get two vaccines, two doses. For the Moderna, it is 28 days apart, but for the Pfizer, it's only 21 days apart. And in the third bullet point, you can see the remarkable benefit of this vaccine. So among people who got the COVID vaccine, there are only 8 cases of COVID illness, as opposed to 162 in the people who got the placebo, in other words, did not get the real vaccine. Whereas in Moderna, there were 11 cases of COVID illness in the immunized group and 185 in the non-immunized group. So in both of these, this was a remarkable benefit, so 94 to 95% effective. Now, the final question is how many people were included in these trials who might be similar to patients with Sjogren's, for instance. And so what I can tell you is that both trials included, what's written here is about 21 to 23% of people who had other illnesses that would be placing them at higher risk of complications from COVID. So these other illnesses included hypertension, included obesity, included heart disease, liver disease, lung disease, diabetes, and in fact, even the Moderna people with the HIV infection. So there was a substantial representation of people at higher risk. Now, I can't tell you how many people actually had Sjogren's who were in the trials, but we know that in the Pfizer trial, 0.3% of the people who were in the trials had a rheumatic disease. So let's go on to the next slide. So these two graphs show you the rapidity of how quickly people derive benefit from these two vaccines. And so in the lines that go quickly up to the top, those are people who got the placebo, and the lines that stay very close to parallel to the what we call the x-axis were people who got the vaccine. And what you can see is that the breakpoint where there was a difference in terms of people who develop the infection or COVID infection occurred as early as 7 to 10 days after the first dose. So what's really striking here is that even with the first dose, you get substantial benefit in immunity with both vaccines. So the second dose is important, but I just wanted to show you this because it tells you that really even with the first dose that you're getting substantial benefit and very early after the first vaccine. So let's go on to the next slide. Well, let's go. So here is just a summary of the side effects that people experienced with these vaccines. And what you can see on the left side is with the Moderna vaccine, on the right side you can see with the Pfizer vaccine. And the graphs are a little different. So in the Moderna, on the left side, where you see the Moderna information, it is represented by both dose one and dose two for all age groups. And so what's shown here is cardinal symptoms that you would normally expect after getting a vaccine: fever, headache, muscle pain, fatigue, joint pain and chills. And what you can see here is that clearly there was a substantial increase in these symptoms of people who got the real dose of the real drug as opposed to those who got the placebo. But even some people getting placebo, of course, had joint pain and muscle pain. But the frequency of these things was also, these events was also much higher after the second dose than with the first dose. So you can see as many as 50 to 60% of people had, for instance, fatigue and muscle pain after the second dose. So I will not hide the fact from you that that with the second dose, and you're probably hearing this from others, that it may, you may be in for a few days of having fever, headache, joint pain, muscle pain, and chills. That's just the unfortunate truth. Now on the right side of the graph of this slide, you can see the results with the Pfizer vaccine, but here I'm only showing you the results after the second dose. On the other hand though, I've split it to show people ages 16 to 55 and those older than 55. And one takeaway point is that those who are older, 55 years or older, the overall frequency of some of these side effects was lower than if you're less than the age of 55. So the people who are younger than me are going to have more side effects from their vaccine than those of us who are older than 55. And you can see as well that with the Pfizer vaccine, that the overall frequency of some of these side effects is really not much different than with the Moderna vaccine after the second dose. So let's go on to the next slide. So this is my last slide, and then we'll move on to questions. And this is kind of a summary. I just showed you a picture. I got my first dose last week and I did fine. I just had a little bit of a sore arm, but otherwise felt perfect. I am due to get my next dose in early February. So these vaccines are given as two doses, at least 3 to 4 weeks apart. And we really need everyone, as many people as possible in this country to get the vaccine in order to attain what we call herd immunity and stop the spread of this infection. And that's a very important point. If only a small minority of the population get the vaccine, it's really not going to be effective and the virus is going to be here and continue to spread. There are other vaccine types that are in development, which I didn't talk about today, and I've listed just several of these. You can use a harmless virus to deliver the genetic material. You can develop a protein subunit from the virus that is injected, or you can make the COVID virus very weakened or inactivated and use that as another way of vaccinating. But these are currently in trials. They've not been approved yet in this country, so we are currently doing the messenger RNA vaccines. So I think with that, we're ready to take questions.
Thank you, Alan.
Some of you have already posted questions in the chat room.
Yeah, thank you, Alan. I will tell everyone how to ask a question. They can either put it in the chat room and we'll try to get to it, or if they want to ask personally, they can click the bottom box that's in the bottom of the screen called Participants. It'll open a screen with all the participants and there'll be a little gray box that says Raise Hand, and that will put you into the queue at the top. It's not the same as Raise Hand that's on your screen. It's down under the participant list. You click it and then it'll be a gray box that says Invite, mute me, or raise hand, and you'll hit raise hand, and that bring you to the top. I will jump in, though, Alan, while we're waiting for people to raise their hand, ask a little bit about, will any of the vaccines worsen their Sjogren's or cause flares, and what are your concerns about that?
Well, that question is on everyone's mind.
Yep.
And I must say that what we have learned, in fact, Dr. Warren Herlinius did a study of looking at the H1N1 flu vaccine in patients with Sjogren's. And what she showed, in fact, is that the patients actually with Sjogren's had a very good response to the vaccine. In fact, their antibody response to the vaccine was probably better than people without Sjogren's. And with that, there was some production of autoantibodies. So the levels of autoantibodies that we see in Sjogren's actually increased. But importantly, the side effects from the vaccine that I listed on a previous slide, the muscle pain, the joint pain, the fatigue, the chills, they were really no different in the patients with Sjogren's than those without Sjogren's. And they did not see any discrete flares of Sjogren's with the vaccine. Now, you know, we haven't seen that in other vaccines in the rheumatic diseases, including Sjogren's. So we don't have reports of people developing a severe flare of an autoimmune disease with a vaccine. It has been talked about quite a bit. but we just haven't really seen it. Now, you know, many people, millions of people are now getting the vaccine. And I just heard this evening that there is a physician from Florida who developed a platelet disorder after getting the vaccine. And there's a lot of controversy about whether that was related to the vaccine or not. So I can't say with absolute certainty that this is an impossibility. We are learning just like everyone else. But the past experience has been that this is not something that we see. It may be, but again, we have to look at the big picture, which is that this is such a deadly virus that we really should make an effort and recommend it to everyone.
And I real quickly on that, Ellen. So just anecdotally on our Facebook page, we've had a number of healthcare providers who were able to get the vaccine already who have Sjogren's, and they did not report anecdotally any major flares or anything major that they felt. They felt maybe the little fever or a little of some of the side effects, but nothing that worsened their Sjogren's. And they've been sharing that on the Facebook feed. Of course, it's anecdotal, not scientific, but it was good to hear some people have had the vaccine and felt fine with it as well. The other question that comes up a lot is, and the one person asked about Rituxan and the timing of a vaccine around the infusion schedule. But more importantly, bigger than that also, is the idea of immunosuppressants, if you're on them, getting the vaccine. What are your thoughts on that? And what would you tell someone?
So what we'd like you to gain is a good response to the vaccine, since it's so critical to your health to be well immunized to COVID. And it is true that some of the drugs that are prescribed for Sjogren's can dampen that response. So the ones that are particularly of concern, interestingly, are methotrexate and rituximab, less so with the biologics, less so with mycophenolate, not an issue at all with hydroxychloroquine. So this is probably the area where you would best talk with your physician or your rheumatologist about it, because I think each one's going to take it a little differently. I am personally recommending that people who are on methotrexate, if their disease is such that they could hold it for 2 weeks or 10 days to 2 weeks before they get the vaccine and then resume it 2 weeks after, that might be the best way to guarantee that they have a good response. But it's going to have to be an individual decision, because not everyone's Sjogren's is the same as everyone else's. And for some people, stopping methotrexate could lead to a flare. And so that's the balancing act that we have to do. We don't want to stop something and allow the disease to flare, but we also want to do it in such a way that you get a good response to the vaccine.
And for Cheryl, who asked about the Rituxan and timing schedule, would you, as well as the idea of the methotrexate going off of that, would you just suggest for them to meet with their rheumatologist to make sure that it's the right thing to do and what the timing should be?
Yes, I mean, with rituximab, it's once you have rituximab, the effect is going to last for, you know, up to 6 months.
Right.
And so I think many of us in the rheumatology community are taking this into consideration. So if we have someone in whom rituximab would be an appropriate therapy, we're trying to having honest discussions with our patients, saying, you know, I think this is something that you will need, but I also want to wait, if we at all can, until you get the COVID vaccine, and then do the rituximab. Now, that obviously depends. Some people need the rituximab very urgently, and they can't wait. But if there's any option to wait, that would be a better option. But clearly, that's not an option for everyone.
Real quickly, I'm going to go to Beth Harkavy. Beth, you have a question, I believe. So you raised your hand. So if you want to unmute your line, Beth, and ask your question. You're still, there you go.
Hi.
Hey.
Hi, Dr. Bear. Hi, Steve. Great to see and hear both of you. Thank you so much for doing this. Steve and Dr. Bear, you touched on both of my questions in terms of immunosuppressives as part of my question. The one not mentioned was Imuron. So I would love your take on that one as well, which I know you can go off of I think fairly quickly, but patients who are on that. And then also, and this is fairly specific, but if you tend to be one of the unusual patients who severely flares from vaccines and have in the past, what types of recommendations are doctors making almost in a protective way, if you do need to get the vaccine? And under the immunosuppressive category, I guess steroids, which many Sjogren's patients are on at various points, how to handle those as well. Sorry, it's a big question.
Well, let me, hopefully if I forget one of them, let me know. So let's talk about beyond rituximab, beyond methotrexate. So one of them is azathioprine or Imuran, which, you know, the studies have been done to look at groups of patients who are on various immunosuppressive drugs and to see which ones led to the greatest suppression of their vaccine response. What I can tell you is that people have individually looked at azathioprine by itself or mycophenolate by itself or so on. So as best we can tell, there's not a huge signal to suggest that azathioprine was going to suppress the vaccine response. On the other hand, I might, as a rheumatologist, tell someone if they could maybe get by with half the dose for a few weeks, that might, at least in my thinking, guarantee that you get a good response. So I can't, as a rheumatologist, say that it wouldn't have any impact. And if I'm trying to hedge the bets, I have to weigh, could I reduce the dose or even have you stop it temporarily to get the vaccine without causing you to have a flare? And that totally depends on what I know about an individual's particular Sjogren's and what complications they've had. So if you've had, for instance, neuromyelitis optica, which is devastating, and not want a flare, then I would be very hesitant to do that. If I'm treating joint pain, and it might be okay for someone to have a slightly rough time for a few weeks just to get the benefits of the vaccine, I might suggest cutting back or taking less. I think steroids in any dose are going to reduce the overall effectiveness, but it becomes particularly a problem above 20 milligrams per day. So I would like to see the prednisone dose around 10 or less if possible. Beth, what other questions did you have?
Oh, just if, and this is, if you have a patient, for example, who has flared around vaccines, and I know this is a new kind of vaccine, but for example, I'll use myself as an example. I flare with flu shots to an extent that I can't get them. I've had to be on high doses of IV steroids, for example, when I've had them. My disease has totally kicked up. Is there anything in that situation you can do kind of protectively to prevent that? Or is this just such a different vaccine we don't know, for example, and you just kind of take the risk?
Well, it may in fact be the latter. I mean, I think we're going to have to be prepared to treat people who have a flare like you describe with steroids when it occurs. I mean, again, we would want you to get the benefits of the vaccine, but I think someone has to be ready to do something quickly if in fact you do have a flare. And so it has to be a balancing act.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Sure, Beth. It's my pleasure.
Thanks, Beth, so much for that question. Those questions. Real quick, I guess I'll jump to a question kind of not off topic, but do we know how long the vaccine will last, Dr. Bayer, in regards for immunity from COVID? Is there studies on that, or do they don't know? I know it's so new, but what do they think it's going to last? How long will it last for?
Yeah, I haven't actually seen specific information about that. I think we're all learning. So those people who are in the clinical trials, the phase 3 trials, I'm sure they're going to keep studying them. So, you know, at this point, they started immunizing in July. So we could easily imagine that we can test them again and see if 6 months later they're still immune. It's a little tricky because, you know, the antibody levels in the blood that you can measure may not totally tell you if they're protected from getting the virus itself. So that is another problem, is to correlate titers of antibodies in the blood with the degree of protection. And I don't think we have that information yet.
Another question came in from Jen in regards to if they've had COVID and they're due for rituximab rounds soon, would you advise them to proceed with the rituximab?
Well, this is, again, individualized because once you receive the rituximab, you probably really won't get a good vaccine response for several months.
But would you suggest them still, I think Jen was asking, not even around the vaccine, should they still go for the rituximab even though they've had COVID? Is that an issue? The patient had COVID. Should they go for their next round of rituximab or not? Is there any concern with that?
I mean, it's potential that the rituximab is going to overall knock down a bit the antibody levels. I don't know if we have actually really good information to say that that would happen.
Right. So they should work with their
doctor. Yeah, I guess it has to be individualized. I mean, clearly, if they're getting rituximab, there's a strong reason to give it. Mm-hmm. So the only issue would be whether if you've had COVID, you have immunity from having COVID, whether taking rituximab would now make you more susceptible to getting COVID again.
Right. And
I would imagine that you would still have immunity. I would imagine that you would take particular precautions like you've been doing right now to wear a mask and socially distance, which, by the way, provides quite effective protection if you follow those rules. So they, you know, Redfield has made that point that if all of us were wearing masks and socially distancing, that you would have probably around 80% protection compared to the 95% with the vaccine. So I wouldn't sneeze at the benefits of wearing a mask.
You know, interestingly, Kim had this question, which I was wondering myself, but if you've had COVID, do you still get the vaccine? Do you have to get the vaccine? I mean, should you get the vaccine or do they not give it to you because you've had COVID?
The current recommendation is that you should, even if you've had COVID, to go ahead with the vaccine. We don't know to what extent you have developed good immunity from having the virus itself. So as you know, the range of infection is quite broad. So some people have asymptomatic entirely through their infection. Other people develop a mild cold and other people have just an absolutely horrendous course. And the degree of protection that probably will vary depending on how severe the illness was to begin with. Mm-hmm. What's open as a question is whether you are now, having had COVID, more likely to have a more severe reaction to the vaccine. That's being talked about. I don't know if we have hard data about that. So we'll have to keep looking for the information about that.
Have you heard of any of the states prioritizing autoimmune disease patients to get the vaccine? I know every state's different. I've not necessarily heard that in things, but I don't know if you've heard that or not, if they're prioritizing not just Sjogren's patients, but autoimmune disease patients, obviously, would be in that category.
Well, I mean, it's just now that the vaccine is now being distributed to the public in broader terms. What's amazing to me is how we've been kept somewhat in the dark about this. So I'm waiting as eagerly as all of you to know exactly how it's going to be distributed to my patients. And I'm learning more from the governor than I'm actually learning from my institution. So it's really controlled at the state level. The states have a certain priority that they've set up, but you all know that healthcare workers and people in long-term residential care facilities have gotten the vaccine first. But you know, the state of Maryland, where I am now, they're finally opening it up to people over the age of 75, and those will be given in public places, and then it's going to be open up to people over the age of 65. And what you've said, I expect to be entirely true, is that people who are at high risk of COVID complications would get it at the top of the list. We have not yet been told how that's going to work in practice, but it'll be in a few matter of days, I'm sure. And then with the new administration, I think it'll be a much bigger push. I think things will change dramatically in the next week.
Yeah, I think the communication, we can all agree on the vaccination distribution, has been weak in a lot of states. New York State seems to be the furthest ahead in regards to vaccination, what I've been following. And in Virginia, it's been where I am, it's been a little bit haphazard. Teachers just got approved. So now teachers are getting it, but not all the assisted living center and nursing homes have gotten it. So I think it's whoever can get their hands on a vaccine. So I think what the theory has been is if you are comfortable getting the vaccine and you get an option to get it, go get it, no matter what group you're in, no matter when you get offered it. But if you're comfortable and your doctor says it, go get it. So, and I think the other thing we can say is I know there's some Sjogren's patients that are concerned about getting the vaccine, and that's okay. But have your family and friends go get it. And so that you're around less likely people that would get COVID. So your husbands, your significant others, your wives, and your family and friends, if they all go get it, and then eventually you get comfortable, go get it, but you'll be safer if more people around you are vaccinated as well. So if that's your big concern of you being scared to get it yourself because of your Sjogren's and your medications that you're on, et cetera. And I'm sure you would agree, we want as many people to get it, Dr. Bair, as possible.
No, you've stated it very well, Steve. Thanks.
Yeah. Any other questions? If you have, raise your hand under the participant tab. I'll just ask Dr. Bair see if there's any last minute questions, any last minute thoughts from you, and then I'll have Kathy Hammett say a few comments at the end. But Dr. Bair, do you have anything you want to add before we wrap up?
Well, I just go back to the original recommendation, which is viewing all of the data, what we know is that I think this is such a deadly disease, and I think that we have to all take the vaccine if at all possible. And I know many of you have concerns, but this is one of those times where we really need to really push hard to get everyone vaccinated as much as possible. There may be a few exceptions. We're gonna learn along the way, but I think as a public health measure, we really all need to go and roll up our sleeves if at all possible.
We do have one question. I will admit, argue that so strongly that we need to vaccinate. I lost, my partner's father died in June of COVID. It was an ugly death and an ugly experience for the family. And so surely, if in case you don't know anyone that had someone that lost someone, I did. And I tell that story not to for sympathy or anything, just so you can know there is people out there that lost a family member. And so, and it was not a pretty situation with COVID. So you do want your family to get vaccinated if you're not comfortable. And if you're comfortable, you should get vaccinated as well. So I'm going to go to Laura real quick, since she figured out how to raise her hand. Sometimes it takes like 30 minutes to figure it out, and I don't want to not have her ask a question. So Laura, if you can unmute, go for it.
Hi, and Dr. Bair, thank you so much for speaking with us. I live in Alabama, which is currently 50th out of 50 states for vaccinating. So it's going to be a really long time till I can get mine. I guess the plus side is I can watch the data and see how people with Sjogren's are reacting to the virus. But I'm curious as to where to look for that information as it becomes available.
Boy, there's so many websites now. The CDC is going to provide this information, and I think it will be non-political in a week's time. So I think that it's going to be the news media are certainly providing a lot of this information as well.
And we'll, of course, distribute any studies that are done, Laura, too, on anything to do related to autoimmune diseases and the vaccine, or obviously Sjogren's and the vaccine, but even things that are related to us as well. If there's a study on people on prednisone and people on immunosuppressants, whatever it might be, if there is something that comes out. Dr. Bair did say it earlier, and I just want to reiterate, we've had about 10.2 million people that have had vaccinations in the United States. Majority, there's not been big repercussions on that. As you all get access to it, more and more millions will have taken it, and there'll be more successes behind that. Obviously, if there's a trend that they see, it will immediately be stopped or brought to everyone's attention. But so far, there's not been that, as Dr. Bair said earlier, and we've had 10 million vaccinations so far. But I agree, Laura, there isn't a great holding cell for a lot of that information. And I know some institutions are following. At the same time, I think the idea is try to get as many people vaccinated. So I don't know how much studies are being done specifically yet, but I do think people are following along and tracking some of their patients. So, and we'll definitely distribute it if we find it as well. Absolutely. But CDC is probably going to be the best place to start to look for that.
And the FDA keeps the track. I mean, we're obliged to report adverse reactions. So this will be reported to the FDA.
That's actually a great point. The FDA would be another great organization that would keep that information. So, Well, Dr. Baer, I'll turn it over to Kathy Hammett, but on behalf of Kathy and I, thank you so much for your leadership and for the committee, as well as some of the other physicians that are even on this call tonight. I saw Dr. Carteron and some others. So thank you so much for all the hard work on this. Kathy Hammett, I'll turn it over to you for any last minute comments, and then finally to Janet Church to close up the meeting. So Kathy Hammett.
Okay. Well, yes, I appreciate everybody being on, and it's good to see some familiar faces. Just want to say that we're gathering new data all the time, and our foundation will be sure that any that is specific to Sjogren's or even generalized to autoimmune rheumatic diseases, we will post this on the website. And just want to say again how fortunate we were to have such an expert committee to take a look at Sjogren's and the COVID-19 vaccination. And having such an expert committee, I am a longtime Sjogren's patient. And the moment I have access to the vaccination, I am going to run, not walk, to go get it. And I think our two biggest bottom lines is that getting COVID is probably worse than the vaccination, but any concerns you have, make sure you discuss them with your doctor and bring the information that we have posted on the website and our COVID-19 vaccination statement that is posted on the website. I have sent that to quite a few physicians and they've just been thrilled to get it. So make sure you share that with your physician. Okay.